Today we're going to talk about the history of Islam. We've talked a lot about what Islam Muslims believe, but today we're going to kind of get into the history of how Islam came about and then why we need to know about it today. Obviously, this is a relevant topic as we move forward. There's a quote at the beginning of your section. That Islam is the only future hope of humanity, and its victorious emergence out of the present ideological warfare is the only guarantee of man's salvation. That's from Muhammad. That word. I don't know how you say that. Kutbi. I don't know, but he says that it's the only future hope. Remember the global Islam thing. Everybody has to become a Muslim in their idea. Okay, either by will or will force you to do it. One of the two. Okay? Muhammad. I did it in pink because I wanted to put Muhammad in pink. I figured that would be good. So they'll probably come try to kill me because I'm being disrespectful to Muhammad. You can't even draw a picture of Muhammad or it's considered blasphemy. Okay? You can't even, so you won't see a picture of Muhammad. See, you're going to break drop that. You won't go to a Muslim's house and see like a picture of Muhammad, like you see those old school pictures of Jesus on people's walls sometimes. You will not see that in a Muslim household because you are not allowed to draw or, you know, depict Muhammad. There was a Danish cartoonist that did a political cartoon with Muhammad with like a bomb strapped to his head and stuff, and they killed him. They put a fatwa on him and they killed him. Because they say if you disgrace the prophet, then you deserve to die. So, yeah, they're not over the top at all. But Muhammad, founder and prophet of Islam, he's born in AD 570. So we're talking a good 550 years after Christ that we've got going on here. He was a merchant, so he doesn't just grow up. You know, he isn't born and everybody thinks he's a Messiah or everybody thinks he's a prophet. He's born, he grows up, he becomes a merchant, he's working. And during this time in this culture in the Middle East, it was pretty much pantheistic, a lot of pantheism. Other than Israel, other than Jews and Christians at this point, most everybody else in this region were pantheists. They were all about all the different kind of gods. And probably when he's a merchant, he probably meets a lot of Jews and he meets a lot of Christians, and he gets the idea of monotheism in his head. And so he is considers himself a spiritual man, and he has all these visions. He has these dreams and visions all the time. At least that's what he says. And initially, he thinks they're satanic visions. He thinks it's he's being haunted. That demons are making him dream this stuff. But his wife, whose name is Khadija, says no. Those are messages from God, and you should listen to them. Okay? So maybe he was right on the first hand. But he starts having these dreams. His wife tells him you should listen to them. So in 610, he says the angel Gabriel came to him. I don't know why the angels always show up. Joseph Smith and angels come to him too. Said the angel that came to Joseph Smith was Moroni, which is M-O-R-O-N-I. It's spelled Moron-I. that's the angel that came to Joseph Smith. At least Gabriel, at least he's claiming Gabriel, came in AD 610 and said, you are the new prophet of God. Okay, so this is Muhammad's claim. He has a vision. The angel comes and says, you are now the prophet. The basic message is there's one God to whom all people must submit, and there will be a day of judgment in which all humans will be judged according to their works, both good and evil. So we can agree with a lot of stuff in that statement. We can agree that there's only one God, and there's only one God to bow to. Notice it's a works-based idea. They're going to judge you based on your works, good and bad. Remember the Muslim idea is as long as I have more good works than bad works, a little angel, a little demon, okay? As long as the angel wins, then I'm going to get into heaven. Or if I can memorize all the 99 names of Allah, which would be helpful for somebody who doesn't want to live that way but has a good memory. Right? So it all starts in Mecca. Okay? Mecca is a city you need to remember about Islam, holy city. It's a great city on the Arabian Peninsula, down there where Saudi Arabia is now, in Muhammad's day. It boasted this place called the Kaaba. It was this big black box of a building. Okay, so if you Google it, you would just, it literally looks like a big black box. And it was a center for all the pantheistic guys to come in, and it housed all these different idols. And so all the tribes would come in and worship at this one place. It was almost like they were going to one church, but there were all these different idols and all these different gods in there. And so Mecca was a polytheistic, pantheistic, idol-driven kind of place. So when Muhammad comes in as a monotheist, he's kind of the outcast when he comes into Mecca. Tribes would make all these regular pilgrimages in the city to worship their god in the big black box building. And why is that important for Mecca? What does pilgrims mean? You got a bunch of people coming into your city.
Money.
Money. It means they got to buy stuff. It means they got to stay places. It means the economy is booming because you have people coming in to worship all these different deities. And it's the same reason why when we see in the Bible the money changers outside the temple. Well, why are the money changers outside the temple? Why are they selling all the animals outside the temple? Because, well, if you want to come in here and sacrifice, you've got to buy this bird, you have to buy this sheep, you have to buy this. And so we make money off of you coming to worship. Okay? So that's what we've got going on. So when he comes in and says, only one God, people start to follow him, and now Mecca's really upset. And so we have some conflict. Okay? So Muhammad's teachings leads to a clash with Meccan leaders, and the Muslims fled to Medina in AD 622. So your two big Muslim cities are Mecca and Medina. Okay? Mecca and Medina. And this event, when they run, they have to flee Mecca and go to Medina, that's 622, that's called the Hijra, and it's the starting point of the Muslim calendar. So they really kind of date Islam back to this event in 622, when they had to flee Mecca to go to another city. So when you think about Muslim holy cities, the two M words, Mecca and Medina, those are the two Muslim holy cities. Okay, from early days, Muslims began raiding merchant caravans on the way to Mecca. So they were violent from the beginning. They would raid and steal things from the caravans. And the raids led to a number of battles. Most important was the Battle of Badr, I guess that's how you say it, in 624. 324 Muslims defeated a Meccan force three times their number. So there's over 1,000 guys, 1,200 guys, and the 300 Muslims win. So what does that do for the Muslim cause? Well, it gives them a big story to say, look how great God is. He's on our side. He allowed 300 to beat 1,200. And so God is obviously on our side. He's honoring our religion. And that gave them some impetus to get some people to come and join them as Muslims. Okay, 2 years later, Muslims repelled a Meccan attack on Medina in the Battle of Azab. That was 627. And then the following year, Muslims are getting pretty big, pretty powerful in the area right now. The following year brought a treaty with Meccan leaders permitting Muhammad to enter the city as a pilgrim. So he goes back as a pilgrim into Mecca in 628. And what's one of the five pillars of Islam?
Pilgrimage.
And you're supposed to go to Mecca, just like Muhammad did. Okay, so that's one of the ones you're supposed to do unless you are physically hindered from doing that. And he goes back in as a pilgrim and goes to Mecca. On January 11th, AD 629, Muhammad and about 10,000 Muslim warriors captured Mecca without battle and permitted Muhammad to cleanse the Kaaba of his idols and establish Islam. So in those 7 years, he goes from, you know, a few hundred people to 10,000 people, and now they're running Mecca. And they've gotten rid of all the pagan gods that are in the city, and it is now a Muslim city. So today, Islam is a major world religion, boasting a membership of almost 25% of the world's population. So one out of every four people on the globe is a Muslim. And one out of every four is a Muslim. Pretty big number. Did you know that the majority of Muslims, which come from numerous ethnic backgrounds and reside in every country, are not Arabs? Because I know you've got the media and you've got your popular ideas, and so when I say Muslim, you probably think Arab. Okay? And obviously, most Arabs are Muslims, but most of the Muslims live outside of the Arab countries. So if you go to Africa, you will find plenty of Muslims. If you go to Asia, you will find plenty of Muslims. If you go to Russia, you will find plenty of Muslims. Nowadays, you go to Europe, you'll find plenty of Muslims. You go to America, you'll find plenty of Muslims. They're all over the place at this point, and they're not all Arabs. Okay? There are factions within Islam. You want to know these factions? So Islam is a religion and worldview as diverse as Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, or Hinduism. So the idea is, we know a lot of people that call themselves Christians that we wouldn't really associate with because they don't believe the same things we do. Same thing in Islam. You're going to have a lot of different people that call themselves Muslims, and different groups would not associate with each other because of the different belief systems. Various factions with differing convictions and levels of commitment have existed in Islam. Okay, so the two main ones, the ones you really want to know, Sunni and Shiite. Okay, Sunni Muslims, Shiite Muslims. Those are the two major factions that we've got. So what happens is Muhammad dies, unlike Jesus. Muhammad actually dies and stays in the ground because he's just a man. And just like Buddha and just like every other religious leader, they didn't quite get up out of that grave. So he died in 632. All the remaining Muslims are like, all right, he was our prophet. We need a new prophet. Who's going to lead us? And so you've got two groups of people. The Sunni group stands up and says, we want an election. We want a democratic process, basically. We want a popular vote, and whoever wins, we'll make them the prophet. So every time we have a new need for a prophet, we will vote for them, and we'll decide who the prophet is. Okay? They currently compose, the Sunni Muslims, are 80% of the Muslims in the world. So if you want to talk about majority of Muslims that you might encounter, this would be the majority. Sunni Muslims are 80% of the Muslim population. Okay? On the other side, you had the Shiite Muslims. They said, no election. We've got to find somebody from the bloodline of Muhammad. If Muhammad was the prophet, somebody from his bloodline has to take it over. And the problem was Muhammad had, you know, plenty of affairs and multiple illegitimate children and all kinds of, he was not a very good guy. He married one wife at the age of like 8 or 9. So really stand-up guy. And so they're having trouble finding somebody, and so they split. One group wants to elect it, one group wants a bloodline guy, and so they split into the two factions. And so the Shiites are the minority, but they're actually really influential. They're a lot more outspoken than the Sunnis are. They're a lot more radical in most cases than the Sunnis are. Okay? They became really powerful following the 1979 Iranian evolution. I don't know if anybody, you probably haven't seen it, but if you've heard of the movie Argo that came out last year that was up for Oscars and things like that, Ben Affleck was in it. That's based on this event. It's because when they overthrew Iran, they brought the Ayatollah in, they overran the American embassy and they kept Americans hostage there for 400 and some odd days. And that's what that movie was about, getting people out of Iran because it was so dangerous. And so, after the 79 Iranian Revolution, those were Shiite Muslims. Okay? Ayatollah Khomeini, remember his name? He gained control of the country. He's dead now. Who's the president of Iran now? Current event quiz for you right there.
Ahmadinejad.
Yes, very good. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Just keep trying that. Okay? You probably won't pronounce it right as well as Christian did, but keep trying. No, the Arab teams aren't all that great at soccer. They get hammered most of the time, I think. So Shiites remain a majority in Iran, and significant communities persist in Iraq and other countries. So we've got Shiites all over. They're the minority, but they're a pretty vocal minority, and they're a pretty influential minority. And we should know about them in Iran because Iran is quite a danger to us. Okay, when you got whack jobs in charge that want to build nuclear weapons, and have basically gone on the record saying they want to wipe out Israel and wipe out the United States, we might want to pay attention to those crazy guys. Okay? That's what's going on in Iran. Okay? While agreeing that no prophet succeeds Muhammad, Shiites believe in a leader, the Imam. You've probably heard of them before, the Muslim Imams, who is gifted by God to guide Muslims. Now, they are waiting right now for the 12th Imam. When the 12th Imam comes back, they think that's kind of like their idea of the end times. So when the 12th Imam comes back, he's going to lead into a global Islamic kind of state. They say they know where he is, and believe it or not, they think he's at the bottom of a well. I'm not making that up. They say they know where he is. He's just hanging out down at the bottom of the well, and he's going to come up. Yeah, I'm actually serious. Look up 12th Imam. You'll see what they say. He's at the bottom of the well. He's just waiting to come back up and reveal himself.
In that prison, that bad
man was there. Yes, exactly. He's down there. He's hanging out with Bane and those guys in the pit. And I know it's kind of ridiculous, but they say when that 12th Imam comes back, then we're really going to have the global Islam revolution. Yeah. No, he's actually good. So he's not an anti. He's more like the. I mean, we might view him as an antichrist type of figure, but they would view him as a unifying figure for all of Islam. Yeah, so they think he's good. More of the great prophet that's going to come. So while the Sunnis and the Shiites agree on the importance of the Quran, they have different collections of the Hadith. So the teachings of Muhammad, the oral law, is different between the two factions. They would both recognize the Quran. I don't know if I told you this earlier in the year, but as far as the Quran goes, a true Orthodox Muslim would tell you that if you have a Quran that's translated into English, then you don't have the Quran. And so think about like King James only guys to the 100th level. So that's kind of what we've got. Because if it's not read in Arabic, then it's not really the Quran. Okay? That's how serious they take it. Right? Another group is Sufism, the Sufi Muslims. And this is the even smaller minority. Sufi Islam has existed from Islam's earliest days, but it was not, NTO, not considered mainstream until the famous Sufi Muslim scholar Al-Ghazali. Was he a villain in the Batman movie? But he sought spiritual renewal among the Muslim people. So Sufi Islam is like the spiritual side of Islam. They're not legalistic. They're not really into jihad. They're not really into that stuff. The Sufi guys are the philosophical, spiritual guys. Right? They want spiritual renewal. So they're the harmless of the three, really, as far as the immediate threat that they are. It has historically expressed the more spiritual side of Islam. And then we've got some, let me keep going here. While Orthodox Islam holds that Allah does not reveal himself, but merely his will. Remember, Muslims don't think Allah is a personal God. He doesn't reveal himself to people. We don't have a mountaintop experience like Moses in Islam. Okay, so they think that he reveals his will through the Quran, but he doesn't actually reveal himself. Sufism advocates seeking a personal experience in oneness with Allah. So Sufism seems to take a little bit of Christianity and mix it in with Islam. Get the personal God idea and keep Allah in charge. So the Sufis promote a spiritual religion in a less legalistic form. It remains a major force today. A lot of places where Islam is kind of spreading in different parts of the world, like Indonesia and places like that, this is the version that's going because it seems it's pretty popular, it's pretty benign. All right. Somebody did the Baha'i Faith when we did our world religion projects. This is really an offshoot of Islam. It really doesn't resemble Islam much, but it did come from an Islamic base. The Baha'i World Faith was established in 1844, boasts the prophets Baha'u'llah. I don't know how to say it. There's a lot of A's and U's in there, but that guy, Baha'u'llah, he established it. You guys can go into practice and see if you can do better than me. The Baha'i claim that their religion is the fulfillment of all religions and that all religions are essentially one. So it's a religious pantheistic kind of view. Every road leads to God, and that is the perfect religion because they figured it all out. There's a Baha'i Faith Center here in Fayetteville, so if you want to go check it out, you know, probably won't, but there you go, it's right there.
Isn't there like a Buddhist temple somewhere in Fayetteville?
There probably is, I'm sure there's just about everything somewhere.
I've never seen it's like either Buddhist or Hindu.
There's even a couple Mormon gatherings here too, so, interestingly enough. Okay, and then you've got the Nation of Islam. I think Aubrey did the Nation of Islam, or who else? Who did? Did you do the Nation of Islam? Trying to remember. I know somebody did it. Remember the black Muslims. The idea that that we've got a modern day sort of interpretation. Islam and Nation of Islam, totally different. They do not agree on things. They do not hang out together. So Muhammad Ali and the terrorists are not the same people. Okay? Those are from two different camps. But the Nation of Islam holds that there has been a modern day prophet. His name is Elijah Muhammad, the wise and honorable Elijah Muhammad. He died in 1975. Once again, another prophet that died. But he was around. If you've seen the movie Ali or you know anything about Muhammad Ali, he actually went and hung out with Elijah Muhammad. And he would talk about Elijah Muhammad, and so would Malcolm X, and so would all those guys. Right? Beyond this, they teach a polytheistic and a racist theology. You know, the white man is the devil. Is one of the things that they would say. Louis Farrakhan is the current leader. If you ever want to look at anything with him, he is about as anti-white and anti-Semitic as you can possibly get. He hates white people. He hates Jews. It's incredibly racist. Okay. Then they've got, this is one of our vocabulary words, historical determinism. It's the Islamic belief that history is not made up of a series of chance happenings, but that Allah superintends history throughout time. Now, we would agree with a lot of that, except we wouldn't put Allah in there. You know, we don't believe in coincidence or luck either. We talked about that yesterday. But they view it as Allah kind of dictating what's going on. Obviously, we would not agree with that part of it. But that's historical determinism. History is determined already. Okay? And then jihad, we've been talking about this all year. Arabic word meaning striving in the way of God. Its striving can take a number of forms, including the daily inner struggle to be a better person. That's the spiritual side. However, jihad is most often used to refer to an armed struggle with the enemies of Islam. So these are the guys that go and blow up bombs. And that's how it usually manifests itself. And you'll hear from a lot of moderate Muslims, we don't all believe in that. That's not the jihad we practice. But what I'll talk about later is you don't necessarily see a lot of outcry. You know, when these Muslim bombings and stuff happen, I don't see enough moderate Muslims come out and say, that's terrible, they're not with us. They're not, you know, it's like with us, you know, when the Westboro Baptist Church goes and pickets a funeral, okay, we all come out and say, those people aren't Christians, we don't want to have anything to do with them, stop associating them with us, they're evil, they're not Christians. You don't really hear that on the Muslim side as much as I would like to hear it. You know, if they were really against it, then why don't we hear more opposition? And I think it's because the teaching is there that they might deny that it's really there. Remember, Muslims deny that Jesus died on the cross. They deny that he was resurrected, and they deny that the Bible is the inspired word of God. They may agree with us on a few things in the Bible, at least up to a point in the Old Testament. And then they will even grab some New Testament verses and say, hey, that's talking about Muhammad. Remember we talked about that when we were talking about when Jesus is promising that the Comforter is going to come, and the Muslims interpret that oh, he was talking about Muhammad. Okay? Because they think that Jesus was a prophet before Muhammad got here. Muhammad's just the greatest. And many Muslims express a moderate view and do not participate in aggressive jihad. On the other hand, the Islamic worldview retains the essential hope that all humanity will one day bow to Allah freely or by force. So it's the idea that we would believe with the Christian worldview that the Christian worldview is not just a religion on Sunday, but it's how we live our life every day of the week. The Muslims are going to grab that same sort of idea. We're going to apply this to every part of our life. And part of the teaching is take out those people that resist Islam, then it's hard to get rid of that. Okay, well, it may be that only a small minority of Muslims are militant jihadists. A much larger number manifest emotional, vocal, or monetary support of radical jihad. And so this is what I was talking about before. I don't think this is as true with Christianity. We rebel against people that give Christianity a bad name. We come out and speak out against that. You don't see that as much here. So what you'll see is a country like Saudi Arabia, who is supposed to be our ally, and you know, we have military installations there and all that kind of stuff, and yet it's a country that houses a lot of terrorists. You know, and so they say, you know, we don't participate in that, we don't do that, but they allow this stuff to kind of happen under their own umbrella. So that's what we have to deal with. All right, September 11th, we talked about this a little bit yesterday, but there's a whole rundown in your book. I would encourage you to read that page about September 11th because it's a really well laid out kind of thing of what happens. But for those of you that, you know, were very young when this happened, but what happened on September 11th? How many flights were hijacked? Remember that?
More than two.
Three.
Even more than three.
Four.
There were four.
Four. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Four hijacks.
Well, okay. They took down one of them.
Yeah, what were the four targets?
We had 9/11, Pentagon, and the White House.
Yeah, so we had two were going to the World Trade Center, one to the Pentagon, and one either White House or Capitol Building, they're not sure, but one of the two, but if you've been to D.C., you know, they're pretty close to each other. One of those two buildings, either one would have been unbelievably catastrophic. Okay, so those were the four targets. Two of them made it to the World Trade Center. That's our pictures right here. Crashed into the two towers. The towers came down.
What's so big about that place?
A lot of economic activity, stock market trades,
okay. All
that kind of stuff. So it was like we're going to target the economic center and the political center at the same time.
So why wouldn't they? I mean, wouldn't it be more effective to take out the White House?
Well, sure, but it's a lot harder to get to D.C. They were going to. I mean, that was
why did they just send all four of them to D.C.?
I think they wanted to hit a lot of different targets. I mean, if you got four planes converging on one place, it's a lot easier to pick that out on a radar and that kind of thing.
Of course, he knows because he planned it.
Yeah. So we've got the two that hit the world, and plus the World Trade Center is so big, you know that's going to be a catastrophic thing. And then we've got one that hits the Pentagon, and then what happened to the fourth one? Yes, in Pennsylvania. There's an account of that in the book. I would encourage you to read it, where the passengers overwhelm the cockpit, and they basically take the plane down in a field in central Pennsylvania. It was about 20 minutes flight time away from D.C. So had they not acted about that time, you know, because they were the fourth plane, so what they were doing is they got a lot of word from other people. All right, we just had a plane hit the Trade Center, another one hit the Trade Center, we got one. And so they said, all right, this one's doing the same thing, because these guys came on with box cutters and took over the plane. And they've got black box recordings that they talk about in the book, and you can read over all that and you can kind of see what happened. But the guys basically sacrificed themselves and took the plane down in Pennsylvania so it wouldn't crash into the White House, the Capitol building. So, big heroes up there in Pennsylvania. But what you want to know about this is that not all Muslims praise these events, but a lot of them did. If you ever go back and watch some of the news coverage in some of the Middle Eastern cities and stuff, there were Muslims dancing in the street after this happened. They were celebrating when the planes hit the Trade Center. And all of the hijackers were Muslims. And there wasn't one person in it that wasn't Muslim. The irony is there were a bunch of Muslims that were working in the World Trade Center that died in the accident as well. And so you see they don't really care who they're blowing up. So, you know, we've got to be a little bit careful in the sense that I don't want to whitewash every Muslim as a horrible person. Okay? Now, they're all lost. None of them have faith in Christ, so they're all lost. But are they all terrorists? No, of course they're not all terrorists. But we've got to be aware that there is a mindset within the Muslim community that this is, if not acceptable, it's something that I'm not going to really speak out against. I may not do it myself. It's kind of like how our country does with abortion. You know, well, I don't really believe in it, but I'm not going to tell anybody else they can't do it. I think you have a lot of the same thing in the Muslim community. Right? And if you've been watching the news this morning or last night, then you probably know that the two guys that did the bombings in Boston on Monday are Chechenian Muslims. Okay? So there you go. Chechnya is in southern Russia. So if you look at these guys, they don't look Arab. They don't look Muslim. They're from the Balkans. They're southern Russia, so they're going to look kind of Russian in nature. They look. I mean, if you didn't really pay attention, they'd be kind of like white guys almost. They're both Muslims. And apparently the older brother that they killed this morning in a shootout was really hardcore Muslim. We don't know what happened to the second guy. I checked the internet before I came in, and they found where the SUV was that he drove away in, and it was all shot up with bullets and everything where they had the shootout, and they heard some explosions. So he may have blown himself up already. We'll see. I don't think they're going to catch him because jihadists don't. They go into these things wanting to die. You know, because they think if they die, then they go straight to heaven. Because they're fighting in jihad. So I don't think you're going to capture this younger guy, the kid that's 19, that got away this morning. He'll be dead by the time they find him this afternoon. I mean, I think it'll be, if it hasn't happened already, it'll be happening really quickly. Because these guys aren't interested in getting caught. They'll go ahead and kill themselves. Okay? So with that, even with that, we've got three people dead in that bombing and a lot of other people in pretty serious condition, missing limbs and things like that, that are probably fighting for their lives in the hospital. So we may have end up with a higher death toll on that. Have y'all seen some of the videos from that? Okay. It's pretty crazy. When the bomb goes off, it's pretty insane. That's the bomb going off right there. But that's the finish line up there. So people are just running by, a bunch of people standing over there. I read an article this morning that there was one of the guys. He's been on one of the kind of gruesome pictures that's been going on, but he lost his legs in the explosion. And they said when he made eye contact with the guy with the bag before it blew up. And so as soon as he woke up in the hospital, he called him in and said, "I saw him. I know who he is. This is what he looked like." And that was helping getting these guys as persons of interest. So I thought that was pretty cool. There's a Facebook page out there for him, support this guy and all that kind of stuff. But as soon as he woke up, apparently he said, "I saw who it was. You know, I saw the guy with the bag." So,
bag, what's that mean?
That's where the bomb was. They had it in the backpack, and he just dropped the backpack.
Well, which guy? The guy with the bag?
The bomber, yeah, the guy with the bag.
They're supporting him?
No, they're supporting the guy that identified that guy. Yeah, the guy that got injured in the bomb. All right, Mark Stein said that Islam is the fastest growing religion in Europe and North America. That should kind of scare us a little bit. In the UK, more Muslims than Christians attend religious services each week. Meanwhile, areas of traditionally moderate Islam, from the Balkans to Indonesia, Muslims are becoming radicalized and fiercer in their faith. He talks about in London how they're building this big giant mosque that can hold like 67,000 people in London. And he said that's the biggest, I think he said the biggest Christian building in London is an old Anglican church, and it holds like 10,000. So it holds almost as many people as the Olympic Stadium in London holds. That's how big this mosque is going to be in East End of London. If you paid attention to any news, there was a controversy for a long time about these guys that were wanting to build a mosque right down the street from Ground Zero by the World Trade Center. And there was a big uproar about that because a lot of the guys that were building it were kind of supporters of what was going on. It's almost like they wanted to celebrate what they had done up in New York. Okay? Here's just a map you guys should pay attention to. Islamic countries are among the most vociferous persecutors of Christians, presenting the greatest missionary challenge to the church and exhibiting the most prominent external threats to the biblical values of freedom, justice, and order. So you can see, even the United States is right here in the orange. That's 5 to 10 million Muslims there in our country, let alone when we get over here and we see the numbers that we've got over there. Obviously, it's red up here in the middle. There's a lot of Muslims in severe southern Pacific Rim over there. Indonesia, southern Philippines, that's a big Muslim hotbed down there. When I went to the Philippines, what they told me was from like the halfway point up, it's very friendly for Christian. You know, it's mostly Roman Catholic, so you're okay up on that end of things. The farther you go south and the more remote you get in the Philippines, it gets more and more Islamic and more radical. When you go down into Indonesia, it's the exact same thing. So you can have Indonesian Muslims, you can have African Muslims, Arab Muslims, English Muslims. I mean, you pretty much have everything at this point, which is going to be pretty dangerous as time goes on, because we think we can just identify people. Oh, they're in Muslim garb, I can identify them as Muslim. Well, what if they look just like you? You know, then all of a sudden, they're a lot harder to identify. So, I had one more thing, but it's escaping me at this point. What was I going to say?
Move to South America,
because it seems to be pretty safe down in South America.
Australia.
Yeah, Australia. Yeah, and Australia's good. So there's not a lot of terrorism.
Antarctica.
There's not a lot of terrorism in Australia. Australians have been targeted with terrorism, but there's not much Islamic activity in Australia. And I've heard Australia's pretty awesome anyway, so I like it. I mean, they get kangaroos. How awesome is that? Okay. All right, so there's our Islamic history.